Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Clinic, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advanced stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. This hour on the Mark Steiner Show, we're going to take a look at the Safe Streets program that was instituted in 2007 based on a program that began in Chicago where former gang members and people who had served time in prison worked the streets of Chicago to stem the violence in Chicago streets. And that program was introduced here in Baltimore, Maryland. It started in McKeldry Park on the east side of town in 2007. Managed by our city health department and by Living Classrooms. And we're going to talk about where that program is now, where it's headed for the future. A couple of things happened in the last month that brought that program into the headlines, and they weren't the best of news. One was the death of the man who ran that program, who many worry about how you replace him, and that was Leon Farouk, who had done 27 years in the Maryland State Prison System, was released. Became a major figure in working in our communities and working with men who had gone through the prison system. And he died very suddenly for most of us. People knew he wasn't doing well, but then he died in a hospital when he was sent in for his last treatment. And it really has been a big hole in that program and a big hole in our community. He was a man who could not just walk the streets, but he could always know how to walk the halls of the bureaucracies and corporate world as well, and could had a very pivotal role. So we're all talking about how that gets replaced. At the same time, there was an incident on the east side in a neighborhood that those of you who listened to this program over the last 16 years should be very aware of, in Rosenhausen, where we spent a lot of time doing stories and working in those communities, telling those stories, where there was a cookout, and 12 to 20 people were shot in that cookout. And one of the people shot in the cookout was a Safe Streets worker, who later refused to talk to the police about what happened, even though he was shot at that barbecue that had a lot of implications around drug dealing, and nothing proved, but that was part of the implication of what was going on in that Sunday picnic as a retaliatory hit, many people would think. So having said all that, we're going to examine Safe Streets this hour with our guests. In the studio with us are Garnell Carter, who's an outreach supervisor. Safe Streets program has been there since the beginning of the program, right?
Am I? Yes.
And as we were talking inside the green room before we came on, I know that Garnell spent over 20 years in the Maryland State Prison System, came out and is now working as a Safe Streets worker in that program. Dr. Jacqueline Duvall is with us in the studio. Jackie Duvall is Deputy Commissioner for Youth and Families for the Baltimore City Health Department. Good to have you in the studio with us.
Thank you.
The Reverend Augustine Inwang is with us. Father Inwang is the pastor of St. Veronica's Catholic Church in Cherry Hill, which now also has a Safe Street program. And that program, of course, neighborhood has been in the news lately because of shootings, and one of community residents who have been shot, who are community activists, not shot on purpose because we're community activists, but shot by a stray bullet in crossfire. We're also joined on the phone by Dr. Daniel Webster, who's associate professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research, and is one of the authors of the interim evaluation of the Baltimore Safe Streets program that he did with John Vernick and Jennifer Mendel. And Dr. Webster, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888 is the number here. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page, I'll be checking that to see if anybody writes in there as well. But 410-319-8888 is the number here. So let's talk about this program. I want to see who we can perhaps turn either to Jackie or to Garnell first. If you both could kind of describe this program to us and how it got here to Baltimore. I remember in the very beginning, when this program started, I don't know why I'm blocking on his name, the gentleman from Chicago, Savetsky, right?
Gary Skutkin.
Gary, who was a leader of that program in Chicago and came here to kind of really push and talk about that program. Many people went to Chicago to see it there. But let's talk about the genesis very fast about this program, and who'd like to start with that? Should I start with you, Jackie?
Yeah, probably makes sense to start with me.
Makes sense.
Well, I say it makes sense because essentially the Baltimore City Health Department essentially chose the program.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what was important to us was finding a program that utilized a public health strategy. as a health department, public health is something that we do.
And I just interject. So what do you mean by use a public health strategy? Explain that for me.
Well, essentially what public health looks at is ways to prevent diseases that can essentially lead to illness or death for people. And so we saw violence as a public health issue in the sense that it was preventable death. 15 to 34-year-olds, that is the primary and leading cause of death in Baltimore City. And so this was something we wanted to prevent. And so because we are health department, we felt it was important to identify the high-risk individuals, the ones who were at risk of being either shot or being perpetrators of shootings, and identifying individuals who were messengers to that community who were most like those people, to bring that message about change to them. And so that's the public health emphasis in terms of identifying key messengers and essentially going out to the most high-risk individuals. And so it was important that we utilize a strategy, and Ceasefire Chicago provided that such strategy.
And Garnell Carter, if you could just kind of describe for us, for our listeners, how you were recruited into the program, to work the post in the east side of Baltimore. And just give our listeners a sense who are maybe just hearing about this program, only you heard the negative side of somebody in the program being shot recently. Talk a bit about what your day is like.
Well, let me say first, we went to a rigorous training. Once we was selected and chose for the job, we went through a training through Ceasefire, which was like 40 hours of training before we could actually go out and do the work. And once we went through the training and passed, we went out and we began by canvassing. The outreach workers, they began by canvassing our areas. And when we out there canvassing, we handing out literature to inform them about certain things, to educate them about violence, gun laws and things of that nature. And we do this consistently every day. And as we engage the young men that we are targeting, we have a targeted population and the ages from 14 to 25. And we are after the trying to engage the guys that are at the most risk, the high risk possibly, those who may do the shooting or those who may be a victim of shooting, right? So when we engage these young men, we build a relationship with them. And naturally, in building relationship, as we get to know them, these young men, they're going to do their info about us, background check, whatever. And once they find out, you know, who we are, what our reputation is and stuff like that, this relationship intensifies. And to a point where we take them on and do case management piece with them, right? And with this case management piece, we take them from where we want to take them from is the highest risk and bring them down to a lower risk, whereas though that we can get them to walk through the the program at a high risk of violence and bring them down to a lower level, whereas though that we can release them, hopefully. And what this entails is getting them back in school, getting them into GED programs, job training, trying to teach them how to write resumes, you know, whatever the need may be. And so what takes place throughout this relationship building is that the outreach workers become big brothers. They become surrogate fathers. Whatever this need may be, this relationship, this is what happens. And to date, I'm going to say we had probably maybe 55% of participants in our program in schools and job trainings, you know. And then one of the biggest things that we do, we mediate conflicts, but a lot of time isn't going to get reported. But the groups or the crews that are in our areas that we know of, we settle beefs with them. And it's real easy sometimes with that relationship that you have with them to settle these beefs. Because for real, these guys out here in the street, they not really, really looking for trouble all the time. But what happens is they don't have the know-how to negotiate or resolve a conflict. So when they act on impulse. But what Safe Streets workers have been able to do is actually get into these guys' business, into their heads, you know, and make them look at things in a different light. So in our reality, what we're showing them is alternatives to violence. You know, I want to tell you a story that happened about 2 weeks ago at mediation. We were standing outside, and two outreach workers was out talking. So this young
man, by saying, let people inform me that your hours are 6 p.m. to 2 in the morning.
Yes,
when you work
we work from 6 p.m. to 2 in the morning, and this is 7 days a week.
Right.
we realized that we had to be out there 7 days a week. So as I was saying, the outreach workers, we out in front of the building, and we noticed this man coming by. He's very agitated. And he's talking to himself, so, you know, you look like he's going through a plan of action with himself, right? And as he's walking by, you can actually hear him say, yeah, man, I'm going to go around. I'm going to kill this dude. I'm going to kill somebody tonight. So the two outreach workers, they jump immediately to what was going on. So first they engage the guy. You know, hey, man, what did you talk about? What's going on? Everything all right? So once they got the guy where as though he could talk, you know, they started, you know, giving them some reasoning. So then one of the outreach workers said, you know what, man, some days it's just like that. You know, that's why we carry around this bag of forgets, you know what I mean, forgive people. Sometimes we're going to have to take that on the chin. We're going to have to beat that one, you know, eat that one today, right? So won't you take one of these forgive me slips and take it back around to the corner?
Uh-huh.
So as a guy, he got to looking and he thinking, you know, so the guy said, you know what, you're right, man. So he goes around the corner. Now, he done went back in the direction that he came. So that's one of the things that the outreach workers were looking for, as long as he didn't keep going back around that corner, because then we would have to follow him. So he went back around the corner. 5 minutes later, he come back, had a little smile on the face. So he pulled up on the outreach worker that told him he had them bag of goodies. He said, well, man, let me ask you something. Do you have a thank you slip in there? And my man said, yeah, I think I do. I'm going to find you one in here. Right? So that was a conflict that, you know, possibly could have been somebody's life taken or somebody hurt, you know. But, I mean, sometimes we come up on incidents where guns are in the car and people are about to just start shooting each other, and outreach workers just immediately go into play, you know, and mediate these conflicts. And like I said, a lot of times these guys want the mediation, you know what I mean, because they don't want to go to prison. A lot of them don't want to be shot. You know what I mean? But it's the image and the ego of the streets that, you know, has them, you know, their identity. They must protect their identity at all costs.
Now, there's a lot of questions I want to ask you that we'll pull out during the course of the hour, because you've raised some issues here I want to kind of lay on the table. Before we turn to Father Inwang, Daniel Webster, and during the course of the show, Dr. Webster, is it Daniel or Dan?
Daniel,
okay. Because people are very specific about that. I'll make sure we got it right. talk a bit about the report you did. You did an interim evaluation of the Baltimore Safe Streets program that you published in January of 2009, which was a little bit less than 2 years after the program started.
Right.
So, go ahead.
Sure. Now, I just want to be clear, it was an interim evaluation. We're going to continue collecting data throughout the end of this calendar year, and then be able to do something a little bit more definitive. But we felt it would be useful to the city and to the programs to examine interim progress, quite frankly, because particularly at that time, you know, there were funding concerns. You know, is this worth continuing putting our money into? What's going on? So we felt it was useful to put out what we knew at that time. I want to underscore that in our mind, at that point, there was really only one neighborhood that had really had the program underway full force, in a way that really, you know, was a fair examination of the program's effects. And that's the first neighborhood, McElderry Park, that implemented the program.
Mm-hmm.
We were hoping that we would also be able to examine some effects in the Union Square neighborhood in Southwest Baltimore. But there were many difficulties in really fully implementing the program as it was designed in that neighborhood. Just to really summarize what we found in those that interim report was that there was a very substantial decline in homicides in McElderry Park associated with implementation of the program. In fact, Throughout that our study period, there was not a single homicide. And the neighborhood really went on a streak there for nearly 2 years without a single homicide, which if you look historically for McElderry Park and homicides, you just won't find a streak like that. You would more commonly find during a period of that length as many as, you know, probably about six homicides.
Well, let me back the question for just one moment, Dan Webster. Yeah. Daniel Webster, and so because I recently read some articles about how many people who do research around gun violence are in a quandary to figure out why violence goes down and why it goes up in any given period, and I'm curious how you put the success of that on the doorstep of, say, streets, or if you do.
Okay, sure. I'll clearly admit that. You know, we don't have the luxury of doing science in laboratories and get very precise
right.
findings and that we know with certainty that A caused B. And clearly that's the case in something like gun violence and trying to ascertain the effects of a program like Safe Streets. You know, we try to control for other things. We controlled for the number of weapon-related arrests that were going on in the areas. We tried to control for drug-related events that's going on in the area. But more than anything, really, it boils down to how much did things change in the sites with the program in comparison to other communities that had historically high rates of gun violence. So when we did our analysis, we only looked at the police posts that were in the upper quartile, the highest quarter of all police posts in the city as it relates to shootings and homicides.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't make sense to muddy the water looking at a lot of low-risk areas. You know, as you know, the city risks vary enormously from one part of the city to the next. So we focused our sights on looking at the cities with the highest rates of shootings, those that would have been eligible to receive funding to implement the program. And we see, okay, how much did things change in where the program was implemented in comparison to places that didn't implement the program if you control for some of those other factors relevant to drug and weapon-related arrests going on. And that just sort of boils down what we examined.
Mm-hmm.
We did see some reductions in other parts of the city, but the homicide reductions in McElderry Park were quite remarkable and went, of course, well beyond what was going on in other parts of the city. So that's why we want to, of course, look at more data, so we'll have data over a longer period of time and we'll be able to know with a little more certainty what to attribute to. The other thing that we'll be able to do in our final report that we weren't able to do in the interim report is we have a little more information about police intervention tactics that we'll be able to control for that we weren't able to in our initial analyses.
So I wanted, before we have to take a break, and I want to get into some really kind of hard matters of the future of this program and what's going on in the East Side especially, and give people even a deeper flavor of how this thing works, a sense of how this works. By the way, lines are open, by the way, folks. This is not taped. 410-319-8888. Join us with your thoughts on the Safe Streets program and what it means to the city of Baltimore and where we take it from here. But one of the newest places where this is being implemented now is a third site, fourth site, is in Cherry Hill and Father In Wang. So, Father In Wang, my sense is that you're not a former gang member. But you never know. But
no, I'm not.
So,
that's a good one. You know, I'm not. I'm a Catholic priest, and And actually, when Safe Street came to Cherry Hill, they were using the premises and, you know, to operate until they got to the site that they're here now. But we have been working to promote peace with Bishop Madden, one of the vicariate bishops of Archdiocese of Baltimore. And they started when there was a shootout in Crofton Street in around St. Cecilia's Catholic Church. And there was a need for a response, that is to get all the Catholic churches around to go and, you know, go out and march for peace and register that we are against the violence and all that. So we did that in St. Cecilia's, and it was good. We had a good turnout. And so we also did the same thing at St. Gregory the Great, where Monsignor Nalepa is a pastor. And then we did it also in Cherry Hill. And this was because we had a conference, a peace initiative conference that was organized by Bishop Madden again in 2008. And it was during that conference that one of the representatives from Chicago came and talked about the what was happening in Chicago and how we can model it to reduce crimes in Baltimore. So we kind of jumped in, you know, to the bandwagon to kind of see ways that we can improve. And to register our voices that were against violence in inner city. And we've been doing very well. There was a follow-up of that conference this year, May 27th. And our major concern again was on whether we will continue to have funding for this program. And that was why the Archbishop, during the conference, the peace conference, initiated a Dollar for Peace Sunday and was calling on all the churches in Archdiocese of Baltimore to contribute. You know, if you really want to fight against crime and violence, you have to, you know, register for it, not just by saying, I don't want it, but commit. And so we took that collection and we sent in, I don't know, most likely the money must have been shared to some areas, I don't know. But in Cherry Hill, it is interesting to know that before Safe Street came to Cherry Hill, we had about 14 shootings and 4 homicides within a period of 8 months. But since Safe Street came into Cherry Hill in 2008, we've had 2 homicides and, you know, 2 non-fatal shootings, which is excellent. And it's because these men are always there and women are always there. And so I see Safe Street as one of the ways that could help redeem the city. Because we have seen the effectiveness of it in Cherry Hill. And the men are there walking the streets, like Garnell said, from 6 p.m., till about 2 a.m. And so people know they are there, and they have intervened in many, you know, situations to reduce what would have been fatal, you know, shootings and homicides.
So how many Safe Streets workers are there?
Well, each site in general has about 4 outreach staff who actually go out and do the community mediations and the outreach efforts. Living Classrooms has about 4 or 5 per site, and they operate 3 sites in East Baltimore.
So you have about 20-some workers.
Right. In addition to the actual outreach staff, we have program administrators, we have a site director, the violence coordinator, and the outreach supervisor as well. And those are the patterns in all 4 of the sites.
Okay, we got to take a very short break, and when we do that, I'm going to come back to get to the heart of the questions of the future of this program. Given what happened recently on the east side, given the passing of Leon Farouk, and how all that affects the future of this program and where it might go, because many people are hoping our program list would expand exponentially throughout the city. That, of course, takes money,
right,
which everybody says we don't have anymore, unless we want to bail out banks. But we're about bailing out neighborhoods instead, and how this might happen. Join us here with your thoughts at 410-319-8888. I remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back to continue our look at Safe Streets.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're talking about the Safe Streets program this hour with Dr. Jacqueline Duvall, who is Deputy Commissioner for Youth and Families of the Baltimore City Health Department, the Reverend Augustine Inwang, pastor of the St. Veronica's Catholic Church in Cherry Hill, Dr. Daniel Webster, Associate Professor at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research that is conducting the studies on the effectiveness of the program. And Garnell Carter, who is been with the program since 2007 as an outreach supervisor in the Safe Streets program in McKeldrick Park. Is that right? On the east side. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Garnell, let me ask you this. I really want to focus on, A, what goes actually on in the street when people work, and B, about the future of the program. I mean, I spent many years in this show, for 16 years, criticizing the city and other places for not having more programs that hire former gang members and ex-convicts to actually work in the street to kind of stem violence and deal with people. When you said that, you know, when you're out in the streets from 6 in the evening till 2 in the morning, and you guys have... in your program, men and women who work in your program come from the streets, have done time or been in gangs. You have to go through training to deal with how to learn how to do mediation, intervene in the issues. But this is, I mean, I know that you hit the street, you have a lot of respect, people know who you are, and that you come from that neighborhood, that was your neighborhood that you came from. Right?
Yeah, all the outreach workers live in the neighborhood.
Live in the neighborhood.
We work in. Yeah.
But we're talking about, in a lot of cases, organized gangs, and you're intervening in the middle of potentially very violent crises.
Yes.
So this is not, this is pretty dangerous work. So I want to get a sense from you about this intervention, and I want to kind of focus with the four of you on the relationship between the police and Safe Streets, which I want to get to in a minute. But
let me say this. You really have to have a passion for doing this work, number one. And number two, you can't be afraid. That is one of the biggest things that you can't be, because being phony or being afraid, these young men and women will detect that in a heartbeat, and you ain't got nothing coming after that. Then if they know that you're sincere about what you're trying to do, then they are... ready to listen to you, because number one, the main objective, you're not really trying to take anything from them. You're trying to give them, you know, some different outlooks and situations. You're trying to help them negotiate, you know, through some conflicts, so they are ready to listen to you. And then, like I say, your background does play a big part, because if you was known to be a shooter or a killer or whatever, and they see you persistently and consistently in the street every night doing the same thing, helping people. See, it starts with they see you helping. If you help one person in their circle or somebody in that block or somebody in that neighborhood, the word is going to get around. And then that individual that you help, he's going to tell you his peers how sincere Safe Street outreach workers are.
So it means in some ways, though, you have to, when you're doing your work, even though you've done time, know the streets, have a certain rep from your time in your life on the street, you still, I mean, Safe Street still has to prove themselves to the community at large and to the guys in the street, guys and the young women in the street.
Of course. I told you at the beginning when we first started through the canvassing, you know, as you're building this relationship, these guys in the street, they going to seek information about you. Number one, biggest thing, to see if you're a rat. You know what I'm saying? To see if you ever crossed anybody. You know what I mean? So when your rep come back and say, no, this is a stand-up individual, you know what I mean? He's just an individual that has changed his life and he wants something better. Then these guys, they will listen to you. You know what I mean? Because in their eyes, you are still an OG or whatever they want to call you. But they have more respect for you now, because now you're trying to come home and do something different.
Most of the workers your age or younger?
Different ages, but most of them younger than me. Yes.
And what you just said about not being a rat. I want to ask you, and all of you, to answer this question, Jackie and Daniel. I mean, one of the questions here is the relationship between the Safe Streets workers and the police. I mean, the reports out of Chicago that I read were that a lot of police officers, even to this day, were very jaundiced about working with former gang members and ex-cons, not really trusting that. Though at the same time having to admit in the studies that it has affected the violence in the streets of Chicago. Now, here in Baltimore, the top brass, especially in Commissioner Bielefeld, is very high on this program. He believes in it very deeply, and he wants to see it expand. He really sees it. But that doesn't always filter down to the street level with police, because you're talking about people who have been adversaries in the past. And, you know, some people have the attitude, once a con, always a con, once a hustler, always a hustler, once a gangbanger, always a gangbanger. So let's talk about that. I want to know from all your perspectives, whether it's your research, Daniel Webster, your work, Jackie Duvall, following this, what you've seen, Father Inwang, and your perspectives, Garnell, about how that works. I mean, Jackie, let me start with you and talk a bit about, and then we'll go around the room, about that issue.
You're right. It is a challenge because, again, as Garnell said, they are the people that the police target for arrest and law enforcement. And to have that kind of mindset change that these are now individuals who have changed their lives, people will say, well, prove that.
Right.
You know, how do I really know that you're not doing this as an opportunity to hide behind the T-shirt? Because that's all the staff have, a T-shirt that say outreach. They carry no weapons at all. Their reputation and that T-shirt is the only thing that distinguishes them from the community at large. And so they need to prove that to people, that they are indeed there to make a difference and to do good work and not to perpetrate violence, which they have had in the past. So it's not an easy relationship to maintain, but clearly needs the support of the police department in allowing them to do the job. Now, again, when we have a situation like we did in East Baltimore where 12 people are shot,
yes,
even though in that particular incident there were no fatalities, but there were in that community that same evening, that's a law enforcement issue that has to be handled. That's a police investigation that has to take place. And we are indeed right in the middle of that whole situation. We, by nature of the work, if we're being successful, probably have some information about what's going on. And so the trade-off is, do we violate the tenets of the program, tell the police what we know, and effectively end the program and not be effective in bringing about any long-term change or any behavior change in that community? Or do we say, for the greater good, for the long-term investment in reducing all the shootings and the killings, we cannot violate that?
What do you do? What was your decision?
Well, that's a discussion that's still taking place, quite frankly.
So that's saying the decision in some ways has been made. Maybe usually means a no.
The staff of the program are extremely clear that in their role and for their safety, they cannot and will not inform the police of anything that they information they have about what's going on in the community.
So let me ask this then. I'm glad you raised that the way you just put it, Jackie Duvall, and and before I go to Daniel Webster, because I want to hear your perspective on this, Daniel Webster, and the fathers as well. But Garnell, I mean, so when the paper points out very clearly that the safe and sound worker who was shot at this gathering refused to talk to the police. Now,
That's not correct.
Okay.
That's not correct. Let me clarify that. Safe Street staff will, like everyone else, cooperate with law enforcement in participating in an investigation. That individual will choose to say or not say whatever they do as part of the investigation. But our staff are not separated from or protected from any police investigation that takes place. However, in the course of doing the work that they do and in the course of being effective in that work and in the course of being safe in walking into that community at 2:00 in the morning, they cannot be seen as agents of the police, because that will mean that there really is no such program, that all they are there doing is to get information for the police, and their lives will be in danger, quite frankly, and we will not have any impact on the long-term issues of reducing violence.
So, but on another level, Garnell and then Daniel Webster, we have this situation where the young man was shot who worked in Safe Streets. Two things. I mean, A, it creates more distrust between the police and safe streets, without a doubt. And two, citizens will rightly ask the question, well, what was a safe streets worker doing in a picnic that with people who are accused of being drug dealers who were victims of a retaliatory shooting?
Can I
go ahead, Daniel Webster, then we can go to Cornell. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah,
please,
I'd
go
like
ahead.
To jump in there.
Yeah.
And respond to the last question there. What was a Safe Streets worker doing at that event if there were individuals who might be connected to gangs or drugs or whatever?
Right.
My short response is simply, he's doing his job. It's part and parcel of doing the work, as Garnell described, that you reach out to the highest risk individuals in that community. You build relationships with those individuals. By the fact that you're at a picnic, barbecue, or whatever with them doesn't mean that you are condoning anything they're doing or you're facilitating anything illegal that they're doing. I'm happy to know that the Safe Streets workers are connected to individuals and hanging out with individuals when they're in high-risk contexts, because, as Garnell described in the one incident a couple weeks ago, but I've sat through many meetings where Garnell or Leon would describe the many mediations that go on,
mm-hmm.
and, something that the police would have been investigating, they're not, because the shooting didn't happen. Now, from my understanding, what happened on that particular incident, there really wasn't an opportunity for a Safe Streets worker to try to intervene, to mediate, or anything. But again, I think all the lights and cameras and attention are on this one particular incident, but none of that attention is there when they're out in the streets preventing the shootings on a regular basis. So I think it's entirely appropriate that the individual was where he was when he was there. It's very unfortunately, obviously, that anyone got shot, including him. But that is the nature of the work that these individuals do, and it underscores, of course, the danger that they put themselves in, because they believe in the cause, they believe in this program, they want to reduce violence. And if I completely agree with what Jackie has said, that that if you change how they operate in relation to the police, you'll make them completely ineffective. It goes against the grain of what the program is about, and you would probably endanger them as well.
Cornell and Father, you want to add to that at all?
Yeah, actually, I want to say from the beginning, Jackie said something very important about the model of the operation, that it is to target the disease before it gets you. It is to be preventive. Now, what they are doing is more or less like my role. If somebody comes to me and says, I want to go to confession, and I say, okay, I hear the person's confession, and the police comes around and says, what did the person tell you? I can't reveal that. That is the tenet of my own profession, that whatever the person shared with me, I cannot share with you. It doesn't mean in any way that I am promoting, condoning, and advising the person to continue perpetrating whatever it is he or she was doing. I have to build the trust. The trust has to be there in this relationship. If these men have done their time and they are seen not as condoning the evil and that is going on now, because the young people who are seeing them, first of all, they've been to prison and they've come out, they will be seen as heroes. And there are some young people who will want to be like them in the sense of going out there and doing whatever it is they want to do. After all, they will be sent to jail and they will come out after, a few years. But now they are seeing these men who have served time coming out to tell them, I have been there. It will not benefit you to be there. Whatever it is the problem may be, try to look for a peaceful resolution to this problem. I am not here to report you to the police. I am here to prevent you from being sent to jail. And so the prevention that I'm advising you to imbibe is drop the gun, drop the violence. Don't go after the person who had shot you, because what I see myself is that people will wait for you to come out, you know, out of jail in order to kill you if it takes that long. So what they're trying to do is they're not telling on them, but they're trying to prevent them. Maybe a lot of the time we forget the tenet and the model of this operation. So maybe that is a good point that, you know, Jackie said it at the beginning, it is the medical model to prevent disease before disease gets to you. You know, that is the model of operation.
And how would you respond to that, Carnell, as well?
I would like to say this. I mean, that cookout was one isolated incident, you know, but there's many cookouts that go on in our neighborhood, targeted neighborhoods, right? And we even throw events ourselves, cookouts and basketball games and things of this nature, because what we try to do is draw the individuals in that we are targeting, possibly interview them right there to see if they want to be interested in coming into the program or whatever, maybe at a later date. But you engage these individuals at some of these events, you know, so that they can know that they have an opportunity and a place to come to sit down and talk or whatever. Now, that day, I mean, nobody could have stopped that from happening. You know what I mean? Like, we have a hat, T-shirt, and a cell phone. At any time, any night, I mean, we could be shot anywhere. You know what I'm saying?
You could. But
we could. Yep. You know what I mean? So, like I said, that was an isolated incident. Nobody knew that was going to happen or whatever. And during our job, you know, we come across cookouts, family little parties, bar parties, whatever. We stop, gauge, pulsate to see what's going on in the crowd and everything, because a lot of these, like I said, we from the neighborhood, so we know just about everybody that's in there. So you're saying your highs and everything, is everything all right? Then you're trying to move on. You know what I'm saying? So that was just doing his job.
So, and you're seen in the neighborhood, you feel you're seen as peacemakers.
Yes. I mean, and the key thing is this. This is one of the key things. Not only are we targeting our targeted population, but one of the things that we are trying to change in our communities is the disharmony of the residents. We're trying to bring harmony back. And that's what these residents see in us now. When we walk through, you know, the older folks say, God bless you, may God be with you at night, and things like that. So we're bringing hope back, not only to the people that we are targeting, but to the residents, because they want some kind of peace and some tranquility back in their neighborhood. So when they see us, some of them even equivalent us to guardian angels, which we have to make a distinction between that and right. Let them know.
Oh, you mean the organization guardian angels?
Yeah, yeah, right, you know right, what I'm right, saying? Right. And, you know, and it's out of love right. of seeing us what we do, you know what I'm saying? So that could took place at any time, anywhere, you know. It's just sad that it did.
It is sad that it did. I wanted to get that on the table because I think it's an important question that the papers didn't really cover it. Thrilling enough, maybe because they've been crimped for their own time and money, and I wanted to get this out on the table. I think it's really an important issue. And the other important issue that is about the future, where this program goes. And one of the things, Daniel Webster, that and I don't want to put words in your mouth, I'm just saying what was in the paper, you were quoted as worrying about the transition of, say, streets with the death of Leon Farouk, who is, as I said earlier, for those just tuning in, was the initial director of this program, a man who spent 27 years in the state prison system, who found himself in prison and came out and had become this huge presence and positive force in this community, to know how to walk the corner and also know how to walk the corporate boardrooms to kind of make these programs work. He was really a very unique and amazing human being. So Daniel, why don't you start? We only have like 8 or 9 minutes left here, and I want to make sure we get this part out about where the future's going and your thoughts now. Daniel?
Well, Leon's passing was just an amazing blow to, yes. to the community, to Baltimore, and
to many of us personally.
Yeah, to many yes. of us personally. Right. He's just an amazing human being, as you just said. And I think it's, you know, just to be honest, I think whenever someone like that passes, it's quite understandable that there's going to be a void, and it's going to take some time to sort of fill that space. But what Leon, I think, was really doing there is building something that lived beyond his own life. It's clear that he has followers there. And Garnell and Mayama's team are just amazing individuals that are looked up in the community. So I'm optimistic. I'm hopeful, but I think it's also reasonable to expect that there's going to be a period where on the east side there's going to be a period where people sort of figure out new roles, figure out how you accomplish the kind of things that Leon was able to accomplish. And Garnell mentioned before, so much of this is about relationships, and Leon had particular relationships with people, and now others are going to have to build those relationships too.
So where do you all see that, from your perspective, where you see this going and what's going to happen? Jackie?
Well, our intention is to expand the program because the extent of violence in Baltimore City requires an expansion. Mm-hmm. And I want to be real clear about something in reference to the relationship with law enforcement. Safe streets will not be successful if law enforcement is not a partner in the sense of supporting the program and doing the work that they do. This is not an effort to replace law enforcement. This is not better or it is simply different than. And we need many other strategies to attack this problem because this problem is at epidemic proportions. We need much more of this, and it's our intention with funding that we have actually put our proposal, responded to proposals about, is to expand the program. Because when you look at a public health perspective, you can contain something in one area, and there are other areas where this epidemic is still
exactly
taking off.
Yes.
Leon, as Daniel said, Leon knew the importance of this not being a program about him, but being a program that was not about his leadership either or anyone who's the leader of the program, but in the community owning this problem and standing up and saying, as a community, we will not tolerate this. Because leaders will come and go, officers will be present or not present, funding will come and change, all of these things will happen. The community has now tolerated violence being the only option for settling disputes until the community, perhaps with all of our help, law enforcement, Safe Streets, everyone else, until that community says we will not tolerate this, there will only be some change, but there will not be the kind of change that we need in Baltimore City to turn this thing around.
And we only have a few minutes left here. I'd like to get both your thoughts, Garnell, and this.
I want to say this, right, for everyone that knew Leon Farouk and loved Leon Farouk. I want you to look at the program as this. There's a Leon Farouk and every one of them outreach workers that are out there working right now. And our Safe Street team in East. Leon taught us how to strategize. He taught us how to communicate. He taught us a lot of things. He mentored us every night. You know what I mean? But we're the ones out there doing the work. And this work is going to continue beyond Leon, myself, and everybody else here. It is a campaign, a mission against violence. And we got to be serious about this mission. Just like we have a campaign against terrorism, a campaign against any disease that affects us, we got to have the same seriousness and commitment and dedication to this campaign and mission about stopping violence in Baltimore City, but not just in Baltimore City, throughout this United States. You know, so we need a Safe Streets in almost every high-risk area where there's a lot of violence. You know, so what I would say to anybody that wants to support and help Safe Streets, help us open up more.
Well, anyway, we have about a minute.
Yeah, I think Jackie said it very well. This was not an individual program. It is a program of the public health, right? So, and we're talking about funding, and we're talking about having people who believe in it, and we have many of them who believe in it because of the effectiveness of it and how it has turned the cities or the areas or the posts where they're operating around. So we shouldn't see it as a terrorist group looking at a leader. We should be looking at where is the funding coming from. And that is the most important thing. That was why the Archbishop committed that dollar for Sunday, for everybody to commit.
Now, one of the things that I wish we had more time, we will have more time, we'll continue our look at Safe Streets over this coming year, and I look forward to actually getting out there and walking with you.
Yes.
On those streets, Garnell. They get a feel and smell it myself. And it is important because I think that one of the things I say often to people is that there is nothing more powerful than the thug who's turned to peace. Mm. And these programs are very powerful. And the next hour we're going to explore with other people from the community who do work on their own without funding, and those who have funding are losing their funding, working in the streets with gangs and young people in communities, and hear their story as well. So stay with us for that in the next hour. I want to thank Garnell Carter for your work in the street and everything else you do and being in the studio here. Dr. Duvall, pleasure to have you in the studio. And
thank you.
And putting perspective here. Dr. Webster, same to you. Thank you so much for being part of this. And Reverend Inwin, good to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. And we will be right back with our next set of guests right at the top of the hour. So stay with us.
No, thank you.